lads and ladies, and today I am going to be doing the Elizabethan part of the GCSE. Now, I was just listening over to my intro to Germany, and I realised that I said it was OCR, but it's actually WJEC Educas. I don't even know. I'm just talking absolute bollocks here. But yeah, I'm going to do one for Elizabethan because I do have my mock tomorrow and I have not done any revision, so I'm actually sister screwed. But we're just going to go with it. We're just going to throw caution to the wind and we're going to see if this helps me. Now, I am going to do it in all the different topics, and I have got a couple of resources here, so but I wouldn't trust me in the slightest. So I would go through your revision while you're listening to this, if you do listen to this, just as a heads up. I remember also I was listening over, I had a really bad cold when I was doing the Germany one, and I sounded like really stupid because I kept on going like hopefully we're not going to have any more of that, and I am very, very well at the moment, so let's get this party started. Right, so topic one, the Elizabethan government. So, let's just run through the Tudor family tree really quickly. So, you have Henry VII and the Elizabeth of York, who gave birth to Arthur, Henry VIII, who's very important, Margaret and Mary. Now, Henry VIII obviously had all of these wives, and Catherine of Aragon, one of his wives, had Mary first, who was the really mean one who, like, chopped everyone's heads off. And she married Philip of Spain, who was also very mean, because he was all about the Spanish Armada. You have Anne Boleyn, who gave birth to Elizabeth I, who was obviously very important. And Jane Seymour, who gave birth to Edward VI, who died at 15. You also have Margaret from earlier on, and who married James IV, who then gave birth to James V, and then Mary of Guise, I don't know, who gave birth to Mary, Queen of Scots, and Francis of France. So that was a quick run through. You have Henry VIII. Now, Henry VIII was very famous for the dissolution of monasteries. So when the Pope refused the divorce between Henry and the Catherine of Aragon, because she looked like a horse or whatever, Henry broke away from the Roman Catholic Church in 1533, and made himself head of the new Church of England. So that's when he disillusioned all the monasteries. So Edward VI was the son of Henry and Jane Seymour. He was raised Protestant and became king in 1547, aged 9. He was assisted by his advisors and Catholic sister Mary I, who absolutely despised him. Mary I was the daughter of the Catherine of Aragon. She undid all of what Edward had done because she was Catholic as hell. She introduced horrid rules against Protestants, hence Bloody Mary. You then have Elizabeth I, who's obviously very important as the course is named after her. Now, before the coronation of her, she was daughter of Henry and Anne Boleyn. She had no claim to the throne whatsoever after her mother's ill intentions, because the divorce was a messy thing, so people didn't believe that she was right for the throne. She was Protestant. Elizabethan was suspected of treason in the Wyatt Rebellion and put in the Tower with not enough evidence. After her coronation, her expectations were to be really just and popular after Mary's messy reign. Her coronation was in 1559, and it was glorious and fab spectacular, and it was like a drape show. She was well-educated, young, pretty, and she spent money quickly, but she was quick-witted and ill-tempered because she had that awful, awful red hair. Now, propaganda was very important for the lovely new sweet queen. So the progresses were used to court popularity. These included touring the country, staying with nobles, receiving free accommodation, food, drink, and entertainment. For 10 weeks, 200 people accommodated her, so it was very, very popular. Now, let's talk Reformation. So, this is where people get very confused, because if you're doing America and Elizabeth, you have this guy called Martin Luther. Martin Luther, not Martin Luther King, he was a monk, which consisted of hard work, praying, fasting, blah, 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 blah. His first act of rebellion was when he became a monk. He was angered by the fake salvation selling. Now, I don't remember what these are called. Let me just look it up in my book. I don't think this is anywhere near sort of the local government or anything. But fake salvation selling, yeah. I think we should just leave it at that because I can't find it at the moment. But if you can, then that's good. I'll probably have to find it afterwards, but I won't keep us waiting for too long. He wrote a 95 thesis, which were 95 complaints about this. He was jailed for heresy and translated the Bible from Latin to German. So I think he was sort of part of this whole, you know, thing about the dissolution of monasteries and stuff. Now, I forgot to put in portraits about Elizabeth's propaganda. Now, portraits were very important because, you know, they represented who she was, very beautiful. There were lots of different, like, secret signs, you know, like pearls was sort of, wasn't it like purity or something, and having a stoat meant you were royal, and all of these different things, like having ships in the background showed that you were strong and things like this. Very silly stuff, but stuff nonetheless. Now we have the Privy Council, which is probably one of the most important subjects you have. So the body of advisors and ministers appointed by Elizabeth to help her rule. Members of the noble and gentry classes and archbishops. So we'll go through the stack in a minute. The Privy Council met two or three times a week. Latter in her reign, they only met for urgent matters. So when the Queen caught smallpox and the threat of Mary, Queen of Scots, went problems, she actually barely attended any of the meetings because she was so busy being young and beautiful and ginger. Now the three main sort of reasons of the Privy Council was to advise the Queen, to watch over the day-to-day government, and to consider petitions from private individuals. Local government, let's talk all about this. So, the Justice of Peace maintained law and order, wealthy country gentleman, was very unpaid, the Lord Lieutenant, chief of royal officials, wealthy landowner, Privy Councillor, in charge of the local militia, and he had one each county. The Sheriff, concerned with legal affairs and delivering prisoners and stuff. Parish constable was very unpaid and given ranges of duties. Night watchman paroled the night time for criminals. And overseer of the poor sort of collected taxes and gave them to other people. And just saw that everything was okay and looking after hostels and things. Now let's quickly run through Elizabethan Parliament. As a main thing. So it had a lot less power than it does today. The Queen had power to call and dismiss it. She would choose topics to debate. There were actually only 10 meetings held in the latter of her reign in the last 3 years. It sat less than 3 years in her 45-year reign. Reasons for calling Parliament. So you actually had to call Parliament. They don't have it like day-to-day debates like we have now. But reasons for calling Parliament. Granting taxes, passing laws and discussing war, so just general day-to-day bits and bobs. Now, what is very important is that the Marian debt, which was the debt Mary first had left the country after her death, so Queen Lizzie inherited all of this, and she capped all the household wages, and she sort of tried to stop inflation as much as she could, but we'll see later on why that was such a big deal and why it was so hard. So, freedom of speech. Lizzie held a small parliament and it met every 4 years. She made it clear that the House of Commons had complete free speech. She believed the parliament weren't allowed to discuss religion, foreign policy, and Lizzie's personal matters like marriage. So, in the late 16th century, which was like 1500s, before her reign, freedom of speech was an ancient and undoubted privilege. So it was something that people sort of craved in a way. Now let's just run through some of the lads in the Privy Council, namely three different boys that you really should remember. You had Francis Walsingham, William Cecil, and Robert Dudley. You have a couple more, like Christopher Hatton, and Robert Devereux and Robert Cecil, but they're not as important. So we'll just quickly run through the three top dogs, and then we'll do a couple of notes on the others. So Francis Walsingham was basically the Sherlock Holmes of the Privy Council. So He was an international spy, basically, and he supported English military in Holland. He uncovered many plots for murdering Elizabeth from Puritans and extremist Catholics, such as the Babington plot, the Ridolfi plot, and the Spanish Armada. So he was knighted in 1577, and he trialled Mary Queen of Scots. So you don't need to know much, but he was basically Sherlock Holmes. So William Cecil, he is the Lord Treasurer, and he is the Principal Secretary. He worked with the Queen for many years, 40 years to be exact, and he was really, really close to her. He worked in finance, so he was a bit of a nerd, so he was very tactful. He believed that loyalty was very important, and he created intelligence services home and abroad. He provided lots of efficient methods for Elizabeth propaganda. So he was basically just a little scrawny nerd who followed Elizabeth around because he thought she was really cool. Robert Dudley. Now, Robert Dudley and William Cecil were not friends because, actually, Robert Dudley was the only man who was allowed to touch Elizabeth, like, physically touch her. So, obviously, William Cecil, our little wet snob, was very jealous of this, so he was actually rumoured to be having an affair with Elizabeth because, you know, she was so touchy about marriage. Dudley had traditional ambitions with military success and fame. He fought the French and commanded an army in Holland. He was banished from court when suspected of wife's murder, so there was a bit of controversy over that. He was a very, very movie bloke. He was knighted in, I just wrote 150, so I don't think that's right, so you have to look that up. Let's see. He was knighted 1585? I've no clue. And he can speak Italian, Latin, and French, so very, very crazy cool cat. So let's just quickly go over Christopher Hatton. So he was a moderate Protestant, and he was the Vice Chamberlain of the Household and a member of the Privy Council. He organised the Queen process, basically, so... And he was Lord Chancellor, so he wasn't that exciting, not as the two guys. So, this is the one I like the least, because it feels like a really, you know, useless topic. The next one, so I'll see you then. Okay, so topic two, lifestyles of the rich and the poor. So we'll just quickly go through all the social statuses and stuff. So you obviously had the monarch, who was Queen Dizzy Miss Lizzie. You then had the nobles and lords, who earn a lot of money, 6,000, which is not a lot now, but it was then. Nobles and lords, and they owned a lot of land. Then you have the gentry, which is kind of like... I don't really have a sort of a good example, but they were just like the wannabe nobles and lords. They just wanted to be like really, really rich, and they tried to copy, you know, the costumes, the houses, the lifestyle, but they just weren't rich enough to afford it. So they had less families, and they owned, and they had less land, and they actually only earned 2,000 a year, so that's £4,000 less. So you can't really, you know, pretend to be the gentry on that much money. Anyway, it then splits up into two. So you had professionals, which were the emerging middle class, so like lawyers, schoolmasters, physicians, and then you had wealthy merchants on the same tier, which were like selling precious goods and stuff. Under professionals, you have tenant farmers, who earned a lot, who had a lot of land, and then on the same one you have yeomen, which owned their own property and had some servants and some land. So, you know, it's just getting not badder, but lesser and lesser. Then you had skilled artisans who were like blacksmiths, and then you had cottagers who had small farms and industries such as spinning, and then you had the poor and unemployed, so no food, land, money, job or skill, and landless, unskilled labourers, seasonal workers, unemployed for certain times of the year. So they're on the same tier, but that's it, really. You then have the rich, so let's talk about the rich. So housing-wise, many homes of the rich were medieval, the communal halls where everything happened, increased light, large fireplaces, lower ceilings, geometric patterns to improve living conditions. So houses were always symmetrical and were styled in an E or an H. Windows were large and glazed with leaded glass. So see, I really don't like this topic because it just feels absolutely useless because you're literally just describing really posh houses. Okay, but we'll still have to go on with it because you need to know it. So, education. The sons of wealthy nobles and lords were tutored at home. They received education and learned lots and lots of cool languages. Social etiquette, hunting, hawking, and dancing were taught. Also, daughters would be tutored by governesses, taught how to run the household. Fashion. You know, they wore the latest trends, wearing fine silk, linen, and velvet. So they wore, like, doublets, breeches, stockings, leather shoes. Women would wear farthingales, gowns, stockings, ruffs, jewellery, just everything that Elizabeth was wearing, really. So it was just basic stuff. So the household. So the wife of the nobleman would supervise day-to-day runnings of the house. They had servants' quarters. There were long, wide galleries so they could dance and stuff. New home designed to divide between servant and master. Lizzie's courtiers would change their houses to her preference on the royal progresses because she was very, very fussy. Now, let's get on to the lower classes. So, housing-wise, they're really small houses. They had cottages, which was one room shared with animals. The floor was earth, timber frame, thatch roof. So, you know, if you lit a match in there, you'd probably be dead. Those with little money had glazed windows, separate bedrooms, and a parlour and a kitchen. So, again, you're just trying to mock the rich. So, fashion, you were just basic leather shoes, wooden stockings, leather breeches, waistcoats, jackets, mantles, and kerchiefs. Education and leisure. So, they had inns, taverns, they had gambling in cock or bear biting, playing cards or dice, fishing, archery, watching plays. Those who could afford education sent their children to parishes. Working day, so it was 12 hours, 12 a.m. to 5 p.m. Your main meal was basically like vegetable sludge. You had a really low life expectancy and only few infants lived past 5. So your diseases, like smallpox, typhus and influenza. So they're pretty popular at the moment in like lower income countries. So just think about it like that. So let's get on to some of the most important parts, which was the causes of poverty. Now you find this, if you do Crime and Punishment, you do go over this a lot. Now, let's talk about this. So, causes of poverty. So, you had bad harvests. So, especially in the late 16th century, there was really bad harvests, which caused a steep rise in food prices and increased the level of starvation. Changes in farming methods. So, less people kept actual crops and started keeping livestock. So, you need less people for that. So, people became unemployed. Rising population, so 2.7 million in the 1540s to 4.1 million by... Okay, my mum's calling me for dinner. I'll probably split this into two, but I'll be back. Hi guys, sorry about that. I just had dinner to go to. So we're going to pick up where we left off, which was the rising population in the 1540s. So it was 2.7 million in the 1540s, and it actually rose probably about under a half to 4.1 million by 1601, which meant more food demands, clothes, housing, jobs, you get it. Rural depopulation. So when these changes in farming methods occurred, people were like, well, we need jobs, so they actually migrated to cities to find stuff. Unemployed farmers had to move to towns in search of work. Right, next one. So you had rack renting, which is basically kind of like inflation, but for rent. So sharp increase in rents meant that the tenant farmers were evicted, and then you had more people wandering around the countryside. Rising inflation, wages could not keep up with the rising prices, especially food prices. So, trade and labour. So, changes in the cloth industry. So, a decline in exports caused the cloth trade to collapse. And then, you had even more people who were unemployed. So, you just had more people wandering the countryside. And costly foreign wars and demobbed soldiers. Foreign wars meant that the rise in tax and the decrease in value of coinage, the end of the wars resulted in lots of unemployed soldiers wandering the countryside looking for work. So, you had lots of unemployed people around this time. And then the dissolution of monasteries, rise in unemployment amongst the Christians, and it took away the vital role of charity relief because monasteries took in poor people. So again, you had more people, unemployed, poor, and wanting food, just wandering around, doing nothing. So, this is the one that actually confuses me the most, because the names are really weird. So these are the vagrants, or vagrants. Why would you say vagrants? I guess if you were in the north, you'd probably say vagrants, but I say vagrants. So you had a dumberer, who, it's kind of in the name, it's got dumb in it, so pretending to be dumb to beg charity of people. You had the ruffler, who I sort of think of as ruffling someone's feathers because they robbed using threats and violence, and they were a former soldier, so they were very angry. You had the Abraham man, who pretended to be mad, so that's kind of a good rhyme. Abraham man pretended to be mad. Done. Hoping this would result in charity out of pity. You had the Clapper Dudgeon, who was a really weird person. I don't really know how you can explain this. He gained sympathy while putting arsenic on his skin to make it bleed. So he was just a dumb person. Clapper Dudgeon. Kind of sounds like Clapham Junction. And I don't really like that place. So I guess we can sort of like correlate the two. I don't know. Find your own way. So you had the Counterfeit Crank, who was dressed in tatty clothes and he pretended to fail from epilepsy. So he was just cranky all the time because he had to suck on soap to foam at the mouth. So he was cranky all the time. You had the Hooker or the Angler, which has a bit of a funny name, but they basically knock on doors begging and looking for easily stolen things, and they return after dark and using a long wooden stick to steal through windows to sell. Then this one's really weird. This is the Doxy. So I kind of think it like Roxy from that musical Chicago. But it was a woman who uses a knitting bag to disguise stolen valuables and dead chickens, which is really weird, but that's probably just the way it went. So I hope you can find a good way of remembering those. I'm just trying as I go along. Unemployment and vagrancy. So rising employment combined with economic hardship resulted in the increase of homeless beggars. They were known as sturdy beggars, vagabonds, or rogues. The burden of the poor was increasing on those who paid for poor relief. Vagabonds were seen as too lazy to get a job. By wandering, they helped spread disease. They increased fear in a rebellion because they were made up of like demobbed soldiers and stuff who were the rufflers. They were too enthusiastic about violence, which is really bad because you just want a nice peaceful time. So the public response. Now, obviously, this is going to be really hard because half of the public is probably vagrants themselves. But London was used old hospitals and old monasteries from the Reformation to look after the sick and orphaned. Cambridge, Norwich, Ipswich and Exeter experimented taxes on the rich for the poor. This problem needed direction from central government. So this is when the poor laws came about. So I'll run through those quickly, but I'm just going to do a brief introduction to the poor laws. So this was all sort of headed by Elizabeth I, and it was the first time the government had accepted responsibility for the poor. So the poor laws showed the people who did and did not deserve poverty. So those who deserved poverty were the able-bodied poor, so the people who could get a job but couldn't be bothered, the lazy and criminals. Undeserving, the ill, the sick, elderly, disabled and impotent poor, which are the people who were actually poor and couldn't get a job. So the poor laws provided a nationwide compulsory system for poor relief. So it was a law, it was a bunch of laws. So I think you only really need to know about three of these. I've got six written down, so it'll probably be good to learn those. Another thing, so we'll just do a little bit about how previous monarchs sort of dealt with poverty. So Edward VI ordered vagrants to be branded with a V and 2 years hard labour. Henry VIII ordered vagabonds to be whipped. So yeah, this, you know, all of this, population went up, pressure from jobs and supplies, social unrest, economic hardship. So you've just got all of it just encouraging poverty, which was not good. So the poor laws, we can finally get onto these. So probably one of the earliest poor laws was 1563, the Statute of Artificers. I don't know how to say this, I'm just gonna look it up in the book really quickly. Statute of Artificers, yeah. Okay, so it was compulsory for boys to serve a 7-year apprenticeship in a craft or trade, maximum wage limits set. So it tried to create employment, but it tied them down to one area, and we like a bit of a wandering man. So the next one was the Vagabonds Act in 1972. Severe penalties against vagrants, JPs to register poor at their parish, local people to pay poor rate, overseers of the poor appointed. So punishments were really harsh under the Vagabonds Act. The government, in acceptance of need, the Act did nothing to remove the causes of poverty. They just sort of, like, became really mean about it. Now, I'm just going to go over quickly when Elizabeth actually started reigning. I haven't written it down. But I know she finished reigning in 1603-01, so that's not a hard thing to remember. 1558, so that's when she started doing it, so that's probably quite an important thing to remember. Anyway, back to the Poor Laws Act. So, vagabonds, yeah, severe stuff. So that's quite simple. 1576, which was 4 years after the Vagabonds Act. Act for the relief of the poor. Now, this is probably quite a chunky thing, and actually three of the laws that were passed are named after this, so you don't need to remember many more names. So the JPs built 2 houses of correction in each county. JPs employed people to do this. Those who refused sent to houses of correction. So it helped provide for vagrants. Vagrants punished for not finding work. Act was useless because the enforcers of the law were cowards, and they couldn't be bothered to do it. And the vagrants were probably very, very aggressive, and they didn't want to sit in a house of correction all day, so that didn't work at all. So the next one was, again, in 1598, so this was a long time after, it was another act of relief for the poor. So 4 overseers to collect poor relief of each parish, work found for able-bodied people, poor children to learn craft or trade, introduction of compulsory poor relief. So it was basically just poor relief and getting people employed at an early age. So it was actually in action until 1834, which was almost like a couple of centuries after. So that's not bad. So that obviously worked, despite the previous not working. So in the same year, the Act of the Punishment of Rogues. So JPs to establish houses of correction, again, for rogues and vagabonds. Begging was strictly forbidden. Act helped contained poverty and vagrancy, reduced risk of social unrest. So that was good. So that's Act of Punishment of the Rogues. So they were really sort of trying to contain it because they saw them as a disease almost. So the last one, which was at the end of Elizabeth's reign, was 1601, the Act for the Relief of the Poor. So this is the third, this is like part three. You know, so the 1598 Poor Law, which had been temporary, was now made permanent. This became the Elizabeth Poor Law. Realisation of responsibility by the government. So yeah, basically the 1598 one was just sort of solidified, and it set up a legal framework to have, so that, you know, people were really getting their groove on, which is really, really good. So that is actually the end of topic 2. However, we'll just run through how successful the Elizabethan Poor Laws were. So the Poor Laws did not end poverty and continued to rise. The laws did help thousands of people in need of support. The threat of social unrest and rebellion was reduced. The laws reflected a change in attitude. The government now recognised that it did have some responsibility. The system of poor relief set up by Elizabeth's government remained for up to like 200 more years. So that is not bad. That is not bad stuff. I think the only negative about it is that poverty didn't end. So they decreased unemployment, but they didn't decrease poverty at all. Okay, topic 3. So we are halfway there. Let's talk popular entertainment in the Elizabethan era. So this is always quite fun, because, you know, it's all about watching plays, blah, blah, blah. So let's get right on into it. So the theatre was pretty impressive, because, you know, you had Shakespeare at the time as well. So you had the bands of the strolling players. So they were touring theatre companies. They were wealthy landowners and royalty, paid for private viewing. So they would be like, yo, band of strolling players, what's good? Can you come and do a play for me? your house, in my house, if I pay you a lot of money. And they were like, yeah, sure. So the players were like rats with disease, because obviously they were travelling and they were probably like vagrants or something. So the players sort of carried disease. So they were banned in 1572. So that love didn't last long. So let's talk more about theatres. So the three theatres that we'll talk about is the Theatre, which was from 1576 to 98, was ran by James Burbage. So he was a pretty famous playwright. You had The Rose, 1594 to 1600 by Philip Henslow. I don't think this is very important, but it's just probably important just to remember the names. The Globe, which is obviously very famous. I've sort of picked the three most simple names. So The Theatre, Rose, Globe, done. And The Globe was done by Richard and Cuthbert Burbage, who were the sons of James Burbage. So that was in 1599 to 1613. So the audiences were nobles, gentry, royalty, and commoners. And, you know, you had lots of, in the theatre, you had flags go up to show the different genres of what was going on, because obviously, like, you can print out loads of things saying, like, this is what's on, because then people wouldn't understand. But, so, for white, it was comedy, for red, it was history, and for black, it was tragedy. So that's probably just quite important to remember, those three. So, okay, I'll be back. My mum just called me for cheesecake. I probably did a really bad idea of, like, filming this during dinner, but I'll be back. Hello, I'm back. I need to seriously start considering when I do these, but nevertheless, let's get back to what we're talking about. So, theatre, yay. So, the design of the theatre was whitewashed walls and thatched roofs, because those are probably the cheapest option, and the stage mirrored the universe, basically. So above the stage was heaven, and beneath the stage was hell, and a lot of plays used that to that advantage, and they could, like, stage the characters, like, wherever. Prices were really low, so enjoyed by everyone, much like Mackie D's, is what I've written on my cards, so just think of it like that. It's just theatre equals Mackie D's. So the actors and the playwrights. So you had actors such as Richard Burbage, who was a tragic actor in Shakespeare plays, and he was the son of a theatre builder. So Richard Burbage was the guy who owned the Globe and designed it, but he was also an actor. Another actor was Thomas Pope, which I think is a very easy name to remember. So he was comedian and acrobat, and he was a colleague of Shakespeare, so he was pretty close to our big boy, Shakey. So you had this guy, so playwrights, you obviously had Shakespeare, but we know all about him. You need to give a few other sort of examples. So we have Christopher Marlowe, who was sort of late 16th century. He was Dr. Fortus in a very famous play. I don't know, it's probably called Dr. Fortus, I don't know. But he was actually thought to be a government spy because he was such a good actor and such a good doctor. There was another guy around the same time called Thomas Dekker. He was a rowdy comedian, and he was a dramatist and a pamphleteer. So he wrote a lot of pamphlets and stuff. I think he might come up later. I think that might be someone else, actually. But yeah, he was a comedian. So those are just some small examples. So of course, there had to be support and opposition to this, because there would have been a lot of controversy about this. So the support, because it was cheap, the Queen adored it, and there were strong messages were conveyed, gaining support from the government. So, you know, like, Macbeth was based on, like, around what was going on and, like, mysterious things. And, you know, Macbeth somehow relates to James V, who was there at the time. So opposition, of course. Authorities, the eager playgoers were massive, and the police had a really hard time controlling them, especially when you had a guy like Thomas Dekker who was, like, splitting everyone's ribs. You know, you had to control, like, all those people. And religious groups, because Puritans hated extravagancy, so they obviously, you know, and we know for them to be very aggressive in their opinionating. So, next bit, entertainment by the rich. So you had hunting, hawking, and archery. So
hunting, they got actual parks to help put stuff on the table. So deer was the biggest prey. So the more you hunted, the more you ate, basically. Hawking, trained bird being released and sent to kill prey, a bell attached to locate. Archery was popular pastime at the turn, with men over 24 after church. So that was fun. Just got to shoot down some arrows after praying to Jesus. You also had dancing. So dancing. So you would dance and you'd also watch foreign dancers dance as well. Music was home entertaining by singing and Talis, Byroll and Morley. So those, I'm guessing those were like people who sung. Ball games, tennis, bowls, skittles, Kales and football, which were violent, duh, but I guess football was enjoyed less by the rich and more by the poor. So entertainment by the poor, so you had cruel sports, so you had bear baiting, where a bear was tied to a wooden stake and released dogs at it, and there'll be bets on which dog would survive, so there's a picture of that in the book. You had bull baiting, where a bull was tied by its horns and doggo released, blah, blah, blah. Okay, you know that. So you also had cockfighting, which I find kind of funny. I'm literally 5 years old. So cocks were placed in a ring and they had to fight and gambles play. So they basically just put poultry against each other and saw them fight to the death, which must have been very fun. So the importance. So Sunday was a rest day and it was a day of worship, but I'm guessing that's when they sort of enjoyed all these things. So life was hard, expectancy was low. People were like, you know what, we just want to watch animals attack each other because it makes us laugh. And that was it. In 1585, they tried to ban baiting because obviously they were just losing so many. It was just a bit gruesome, really. And Lizzie just straight up said no because she obviously enjoyed it. So you had May Day, the harvest, New Year, Shrove Tuesday, Pancake Day. It was like party time, you know. I guess they were setting light to bears and throwing dogs everywhere. I don't know. I wasn't there. So, that is actually, the end of, topic four, topic three. So, the book says it a lot bulkier, but I'm just trying to narrow it down for you just so you remember the things that you will need to write in the exam. Right, let's move on to topic four then. Okay, ladies and gents, this is when it starts getting really, really hard. So it was the problem of religion. Now we know that the problem of religion was an absolute roller coaster back then because you had opinions flying around everywhere and because the queen slash king had so much power and so much say that it just sort of wrecked the country. And to be honest, I'm not surprised that all of these wars happened and all of these poor laws had to come into place and stuff like that. But there you go, we've learnt from our mistakes, hopefully. So, Puritans, Protestants versus Catholic. So, Catholicism. So the Pope was head of church, we know that. Archbishops and bishops were there to help. Bibles only in Latin and read only by priests. Churches were highly decorated and priests couldn't marry. Protestantism, is that a word? Monarch should be the head of the church, so people like Henry VIII. Archbishops and bishops helped the monarch, so you didn't have a pope. The Bible was in English, so I'm guessing the Bible sort of catered to many, not the few, in terms of Puritans. Now this is where my notes get all messed up, but let's just go on with this. They had little decoration against the teachings of Jesus, and priests should marry. So then you had Puritans who were, wow, they were aggressive people. So there was no head of the church. So the churchgoers elected committees, simple church services, bread and wine was bread and wine, not body of Christ, blah, blah, blah. No need for any decoration, priests should marry. So it was more extremist version of Protestantism. So let's go over the religious roller coaster. So Henry VIII was Catholic. Then it was Edward VI who was Protestant. Then Mary I who was Catholic. And then, because all of this, you know, there were so many uprisings and stuff because of these different fluctuations, and there was such a quick change, like, every time, and you just wanted to not happen. So, Elizabeth I was like, you know, I'm a woman, I can stop this, I'm not mad like my half-sister, I can do whatever I want. So, she created the Via Media, which was the middle way, which was kind of like half Catholic, half Protestant. Although she was Protestant, she sort of leaned more towards Protestant, but she did favour Catholics to sort of please the many. So factors Lizzie had to include in the religious settlement, obviously it had to be a settlement, but the factors Lizzie had to include, so there were a lot. So unite the country, who accepted both religions. The Pope, he had the power to excommunicate her, so I think he does that, actually. So she needed to take this into consideration. Conservative public, who were traditional in religion. Protestants, she herself was Protestant. Catholics, Lizzie believed that some, in some parts of Catholicism. Spain was Catholic and very, very fiery. And if we remember, Mary first married Philip of Spain, so there was some sort of weird connection going on there. France, wife of king, was thought to be the rightful queen. So that's Mary of Guise, I think. So, you know, France was very opposed, and so was Spain. The public, opposition by extremists. The Marian exiles, aggressive Puritans, wish returned. So basically, the Puritans in the previous way, so there was the Catholic Mary first, and obviously she was so aggressive, she exiled like a bunch of Puritans, and they wanted to come back now this whole settlement was happening. Scotland, Mary Queen of Scots, who was, you know, if you've watched The Favourite, not The Favourite, Mary Queen of Scots, with, what's her name? I forgot her name. Harley Quinn, I don't know, she's in that. Members of Parliament, majority Protestant in House of Commons, majority Catholic in House of Lords. So obviously, Lizzie had to be juggling a lot of things here, and because people had such high opinions and freedom of speech was, you know, she's just sort of like, it's just a train wreck, really. Anyway, so let's talk Mary, Queen of Scots. So she was daughter of James V. She was crowned when she was 6 days old. And at the age of six, she was sent to Catholic France. She married Francis of France when she was 16. So actually, no, Mary first did not... Oh, yeah, Mary first married Philip of Spain. Mary, Queen of Scots, married Francis of France when she was 16. When she returned to Scotland, it was Protestant, even though she was brought up Catholic. She married Lord Darnley, and then she gave birth to James the sixth. The marriage collapsed due to her Italian secretary, who was murdered, so, it's such a train wreck, her life. Earl of Bothwell got invited, the house magically blew up along with Darnley, and Mary abdicated in 1567. So, you know, she was a slut, and that's it, really. I think that's all we can say about her. So, let's move ahead to the act that she had to put in, a couple of the acts that she had to put in to sort of say, like, yo, can we just, like, do this, please, to make everyone happy. So, the Act of Uniformity in 1559, which was actually only 1 year after her reign, after her coronation. So, Protestant book was used in all churches. The Bible was in English. Ornaments and decorations were allowed, so that's the Catholic part thrown in. Clergy wore vestments, which isn't allowed in Protestantism. Everyone attended church. Recusants paid a shilling fine. So those are the people who refused to attend church. They paid a shilling and a fine. Monasteries found by Mary the First were closed down. So I'm guessing they were very Catholic and they all closed down because of the extremists. You then had the royal injunctions in the same year, instructions for the clergy. So they banned all Catholic practices like processions, identifying recusants and reporting them. Preach with license. All people bow at mention of Jesus. All clergy to wear white gowns. Priests can marry with permission. So there's sort of bits and bobs in there which are Catholic and not Catholic. It's all a bit of a mess. So next bit, we have the visitations. So make sure the royal injunctions happened. So 125 commissioners, job to tour, judge the parish's standard and make sure the make the clergy swear an oath. 400 clergy sacked and resigned, and half of those were Catholics. So, of course, it's not going to be easy to settle these because of, you know, all of these problems. So you did have people to enforce it, a bit like sort of like the JPs and the parish constables and stuff like that. So You then had the Act of Exchange, I'm guessing, in the same year, so which was taking money from the church. So Lizzie could make bishops rent land to her and also take land, buildings belonging to the church. The church lost wealth to foreign wars and rewarding nobles. So she was tossing her money around. Probably not the best thing to do when you're trying to please everyone. But she's taking money from churches, basically. That was the Act of Exchange. You then had episcopacy. Let me just flip through the book and see what's going on. Yeah, the episcopacy. I don't know. It was the role of the bishops, basically. I don't know why they've chosen such a complicated name. There we go. So the Queen favoured bishops to ministers. She hoped Catholic ministers would continue, but they just got up and left, basically. The Puritans bought the Geneva model and beef, really. So the Geneva model was basically... So all of the Puritans that got exiled during Mary the First reign got sent to Switzerland, where Geneva is, and they met this guy called Calvin, and he taught them like loads of stupid stuff to make them just go crazy, go stupid. So that was it, really. I don't know if we've covered the Act of Supremacy yet. I don't think we have. But remind me to do that. Oh, it's here. So, and then you had 39 articles in 1563. So this was a long time after Elizabeth had, you know, tried to settle this stuff. These laid down the beliefs of the church. They rejected many Catholic practices, probably not to the help of others. They weren't approved until 1571, which was 8 years later. And all clergy had to swear to follow it. So they actually rejected many Catholic practices. So 39 articles, got to remember that. Probably very important. The Act of Supremacy in 1559. So I don't know why these aren't in order. But this was the year after her reign began. So Elizabeth was the head of the church. That was basically saying she's like, I am supreme and that's it. So imagine Elizabeth in like all the supreme garms and her saying like, yo boys, I'm the head of the church. Supreme Governor of the Church of England. All officials had to swear by this and execute it if refused. So bishops govern the church as well. So they rejected Catholic ministers. Now let's talk about the media. So you had the Middle Way. Protestantism was the official religion. They had an English prayer book and priests could marry. So that was all a bit sort of Protestants. But Puritans actually weren't allowed because they had very extreme views and they didn't want any uprisings anytime soon. You were fined for not attending church, so that made you a recusant. I don't know how to pronounce it. Elizabeth had tried to create via media, or else the Pope would just be like, bye, fuck off. But Lizzie just, despite the threats from the Pope, Lizzie just told him to just go away, and then she threatened him. Well, she didn't threaten him, but she just sort of intimidated him a little bit, just saying like, oi, I've got all this wealth, and even though you can do this, I just don't care. So let's talk a bit about the reactions to the religious settlement, because obviously there's going to be a lot. So Protestants, the new Archbishop accepted it, probably because it swayed more towards Protestantism, and they accepted it. Opposition arose among throughout her reign, because people probably got quite annoyed of it. So 240 to 9,000 priests, I don't know why that number is so vague, refused to take oath and threw a strop, basically. And they probably got executed or mutilated or blah, blah, blah. Catholics, they were like, you know what, at least she's trying, and we get it. The majority of them said that, so they accepted some of it. Fines for recusatory were not forced, so, you know, a lot of people didn't go to church. Some priests threw a strop. Most Catholic bishops resigned, basically, so I don't think that's much of a problem for Elizabeth. Abroad, the Pope said nothing. He thought it was just temporary. King Philip II of Spain wanted to maintain friendship, but thought like the Pope. France was caught up elsewhere.
probably in wars with Holland and things like that, because all they could do was just obsess about Holland. So that is actually
all of the bits and bobs. So there's like I said before, it's more chunky in the book, but I'm just narrowing it down for you lads, just so we can all understand it. Right, so we're nearly there, boys. It's just a shame that these last two are very, very hefty subjects. So, topic 5, the Catholic threat. So this is when people started getting a little bit annoyed. So, let's start off with recusancy. So, a recusant was those who rebelled against the church because they didn't believe in the religious settlement. Fines for recusants were 20 quid, so that was probably quite a lot of money back then. Converting people to the Catholic faith was a treasonable offence, so if people tried to do it, then they were like, nah, get your head chopped off. Laws were aimed at martyrs and seminary priests, who were martyrs for Catholicism. So seminary priests were Catholics who were priests, duh. They were taught in France about spreading the Catholic faith. So France is obviously just spreading Catholicism and England is not having it. So the Act of Parliament meant 98 priests were executed because of this, most likely. I don't have any more on seminary priests. But basically, the priests were taught that it was their duty to return to England to re-establish the Catholic faith. And if necessary, seek martyrdom for their cause. So their arrival, which coincided with the uncovering of several plots by prominent Catholics against Elizabeth, so it just stirred up a lot of beef. Let's get onto Jesuits. I don't know how to say it. I don't know. So there was the Society of Jesus, founded in 1534. Most members were seminary priests. Main aim was to kill Protestantism. So it was kind of like, if you kind of link it back, it's kind of like communism, you know. Everyone was like, yo, we got to get rid of this. So they swore allegiance to Pope and became martyrs. They came to England, encouraging people to not accept the Elizabethan church. They held private ceremonies. I spelled ceremonies with an S, that's gross. So let's talk about the government response, because that is very important. So in 1581, coming to the fact that that lots of people came in like 1574, 1585, sort of that around area. So in the middle of it, the Act of Parliament number 1, the fines were 20 quid and the attempts to conversion were treason, as we've already gone over. And then we had the Act of Parliament 2 in 1593. There was no gatherings of Catholics. Catholics confined within 5-mile radius of house. So that's pretty scary stuff. But then let's jump back to 1585, which was the Act of Parliament again, ordered seminary priests to leave or die, hiding and helping priests given death sentence. So there's a lot of stuff that was repressing Catholics, and people were like, but bro, you're supposed to be like finding peace with the two religions, and then, you know, Lizzie's not having any of it. Anyway, so Mary, Queen of Scots, I don't know if this is in order or not, because there's something on Edward Campion, and I think it's important to read about that. So let's just do a little bit on Edmund Campion. So he was a Jesuit and at Douai College. He was chosen to return to England on a religious mission. He arrived in secret and travelled to Lancashire, an area with a high proportion of Catholic families. He then moved south to preach in homes to rich Catholic families in London. He was arrested in Lifford in Berkshire. 1 year after he came, he was sentenced to the Tower and tortured. Campion was found guilty of treason and executed by hanging in the same year. So he was one of the most famous Jesuit priests ever and a recusant. He was probably like just chasing. But you have a a source in the book which shows him being tortured, which is not very nice. But that's it, really. He was only 41 when he died, which is quite sad. So let's move on to the real beef. Mary, Queen of Scots. She was a bitch. She was terrible. So Mary, Queen of Scots, she
basically, allow Mary sent to France. I think we're talking about the right Mary here. So Mary went to France, okay, let her go. She would lead France, basically, so England could sort of spread their rule, and it was to get rid of her, because she's a bitch. And then they sent Mary back to Scotland, because Scotland would protest, could turn into Catholic heir, gain support, people would try and plot against Lizzie, because I'm guessing Mary, Queen of Scots, was pretty annoyed, because Mary just kept on throwing her everywhere. And, you know, people just think of her as the Queen of Scots, because she was an heir to the English throne. Help Mary regain her throne in Scotland. Gain respect from Mary. Scotland would protest again because they don't like her. Keep Mary in England. Stir up Catholic supporters. Catholic rebellion. Keep her in check. Execute Mary. Get out of the way. Stir her supporters. So this was all sort of... this was sort of saying, like, what should we do with Mary? Because she's really annoying. So these were the main points. So allow Mary to go to France, send Mary back to Scotland, help Mary gain her throne, keep Mary in England, execute Mary. So they had Mary there at the minute. So we've gone through Mary and Darnley, Mary and Bothwell, and arriving back to England. So we'll just see how all of this turns out. So this is probably some of the main... things that you need to know, which was all the Catholic plots, and there were so many. There was five, not including the papal bull. Okay, so we'll go through this very quickly. It was from 1569 to 1586, so actually for the majority of Elizabeth's reign, she had all of this crap going on and she did not like it. So the revolt of the Northern Earls in 1569. So the people involved were Charles Neville, Thomas Percy, and 4,000 earls. So a lot of earls. So the aim was to kill Lizzie and marry Mary back into to the Duke of Norfolk. So this is what happened. So they marched to Durham, which is where Billy Elliot was set. I just don't know why I know that. There was a Catholic mass... I put teasing of the Bible, tearing of the Bible, because obviously they didn't like the Bible being in English. They marched to Bramble to Moor, but then the leaders fled because Lizzie sent like a bunch of people to Durham and made them surrender, and they removed the power of the Northern Isles, because I'm guessing because it's in the north and so Scotland, so they just sort of like were hooking up over there. Then you had the Throckmorton plot, which was lasted a year, 1583 to 84. The people involved were Francis Throckmorton, which is, I mean, you've got so many people called Francis, so I think that's okay. Mary, Queen of Scots, and Duke of Guise, who was based, I think, the son of Mary of Guise, I don't know. So the aims were to invade England with French and Spanish Catholics with the papal money and free Mary from captivity. The events, the Secret Service uncovered the plot and arrested Francis, revealed under torture, Lizzie's response. So Francis arrested and tortured, Duke of Guise was executed, and Mary was banned of visitors and mail was checked. So I think, no, it's not. But yeah, that's pretty simple. I don't think that's very important. But the Ridolfi plot. Now the people involved were Roberto Ridolfi, who was a banker and a merchant, and he was Italian. I'm gonna sneeze. Bless me. So, excuse me. You had Roberto Ridolfi, who was Italian, and then you had Mary, the Pope, Dispers, and Philip II of Spain. Dispers is a really funny word, so that's how I remember it. The aims were the Spanish army would overthrow Lizzie, marry Mary and Norfolk, the Duke of Norfolk. So this is what happened. So Walsingham and Cecil foiled the plan. They tortured those involved. Lizzie's response, Norfolk was found guilty and executed. Mary wasn't killed. Dispers and Ridolfi were exiled. I feel like a lot of these plots sort of follow the same thing. Is that, oh, in the last moment, Francis just comes and saves the day and that's it. But they are all very similar. This all happened in 1571. So this was 2 years after... the Revolt of the Northern Earls, and long after the Throckmorton plot. So I know the reason why people struggle to remember these. Anyway, let's move on to one of the main plots, which was the Babington plot, which sticks most most thoroughly in my mind. It was in 1586, and the people involved were Anthony Babington and Mary. So the aims were to overthrow Elizabeth and replace with Mary. I mean, you'd understand why Elizabeth wants to throw Mary to another country, because she just kept on planning things inside her little cage, and it's like, no, stop it. Anyway, the events. Mary and Anthony traded cipher letters in beer barrels. Walshingham interpreted them and gathered evidence, and the Lizzie's response, the Babington and six others were killed after arrest and confession. So the Babington plot is basically, happened in 1586, beer barrels, Anthony Babington, and they're all killed after arrest and confession. So that's it. We then have the increasing Catholic threat over the course of 1584 to 85, sort of concluding with the Babington plot. So you had people involved was William of Orange and John Somerville. Now, I think William of Orange was a very weird person. I think he was the guy who just didn't speak or something. The aim was to declare all murderers and plotters were to be executed. The events, William was shot by Somerville and also tried to shoot Lizzie. Lizzie's response, ceremony priests and Jesuits had to leave within 40 days. Spain constructed large fleets. So I think this is all sort of building up to the Spanish Armada, which is topic 6. This is a bit of a messy one, actually. Because there was a declaration of war between England and Spain in 1585, so the threat was getting bigger, and William was actually shot in 1584, and then the Babington plot happened in 1586, so obviously it was all sort of increasing a little bit. So anyway, let's get on to one of the other main ones, which was the Papal Bull, which is in 1570, so way before all of this, which was in February. So Pope Pius V issued a papal bull to excommunicate Elizabeth. It declared that she was not rightful and gave Catholics permission to remove her from the throne. So, and then everyone was like, yo, this comes out, we can literally do anything. And of course, Parliament had a really hard time to come up with any sort of excuses, because the word of the Pope was seen as like really important and stuff. So yeah, that was a bit of a problem, and they just got an excuse just to like tear her to shreds. So let's talk about responses to this. So the Parliament issued a Treason Act in the year after. Treasonable to declare Lizzie wasn't rightful. Treasonable to introduce and publish the papal bull. Catholics who fled abroad got all their toys taken away. So basically their house, their guns, whatever. The Earl of Huntingdon reduced power of Elf by encouraging revolt to their people. So they just sort of stirred things up north, so they'd sort of destroy themselves in a way. But that was the papal bull. So let's talk about Mary. Because all of this was happening, I'm guessing Elizabeth wasn't getting very fond of it. And they were just gathering evidence. More and more of these plots happened. They were just gathering evidence, like reasons to like kill her. So obviously this is a spoiler. Mary Queen of Scots dies in February 1587, so the year after the Babington plot. Now, the Privy Council wanted Mary dead, obviously, went behind the back of Lizzie and got her secretary, William Davidson, to take the warrant where Mary was executed. They hoped the death would end in Catholic revolt. So they basically, even though Elizabeth had to sign it, they sort of stuck out a death warrant anyway, and I think they executed her. Anyway, Elizabeth refused to sign the death warrant a lot of times, but then she signed it, but then refused to publish it. So obviously she's had a lot of, because you know, they're half sisters, so they're pretty close. She was furious when they snaked her and blamed Lord Burghley, and she wrote a letter of apology to the Sun. So even though she refused to publish it, they still had the death warrant, so they basically just did it anyway. And they all blamed Lord Burghley, because they were like, bro, why'd you do that? And he was like, oh, but you wanted it, blah, blah. Anyway, she wrote a letter of apology to the Sun. I don't know who the Sun was. Let me just check. the young King James VI of Scotland. So, obviously she was furious. She was like, why? Because we really like her. Anyway, the consequences, no more Catholic plots against Lizzie, which was good. Scotland blamed the council. Francis did nothing. And Spain was absolutely crazy and just started plotting like crazy because they were like, you know what, all of this Catholic stuff is out of the way. And even though Mary, the Queen of, even though Philip, who was like obviously in love with Liz, thingamajiggy, with Mary, he was like, no, bro. And of course, because this whole war was going on, so obviously it was a big trigger. Anyway, that was it. That was really this whole story about the thing. But remember, she died in 1587. I literally can't remember any of these dates, but that's it. So, that's it. Let's move on to the next topic then. The last topic. Woo! Right, it looks like topic 5 was the chunkiest of them all, but what I'm doing that I didn't do with Germany is to sort of run you through how to answer the questions as well, which might be quite helpful. Anyway, let's move on to topic 6, which is the Spanish Armada, and one of the most complicated topics for me, like, ever. Sorry, I have to keep on drinking water because talking just gets my throat, like, really, really dry. Okay, let's talk. Okay, so bloke who was involved, Philip of Spain. So, I don't know if I've done this right. No, okay, so, Mary Tudor actually died in 1558. So, oh no, so I was wrong the whole time. Basically, I think it was Mary the First that, Philip of Spain married, not Mary, Queen of Scots. Maybe it was Francis of France. I don't know. Anyway, sorry about that. Anyway, let's move on. So, let's talk about Francis Drake. So, Francis Drake was a really important person in all of this because he was basically like the commander for everything. So, he led pirate attacks on Spanish ships in America taking treasure. He was he circumnavigated the globe in 3 years, and he was the second person ever to do that. He was knighted on his boat, the Golden Hind. How did I read that? Like, Hind. He was basically a little bellboy for Elizabeth, and he basically destroyed the English-Spanish relations. So maybe he was the cause of all of this. We never know. Anyway, so, causes for the Spanish Armada. So, in 1554, way before you know, all the Catholic plots, and even, Elizabeth's reign, Philip married the devout Catholic Mary Tudor and took over from his useless father to a whopping great navy and army. He became ruler of the wealthiest empire, which was the Spanish, you know, one. He used his power to send an armada to destroy Protestantism in Europe. In 1556, Philip co-owned UK with Mary as she rebooted Catholicism, so she was Mary first, so he actually co-owned it. When Mary snuffed it in 1558, Philip no longer owned the UK, and he obviously didn't like that. He tried to link up with Lizzie, and she knew he was a snake, so in 1559, 1 year after the death of his wife, he began to plan the Armada. So, Philip was religious as hell, and he believed God was on his side, that he was doing the right thing. The Netherlands, who have a lot to say in this, the Netherlands were economically important as they traded over the English Channel. They didn't want to sour relationships with the UK. In 1566, a little bit after he started planning the Armada, the Dutch revolt of Protestants trashed all the churches, the Catholic churches in Holland. Philip sent his boys to Holland with the Duke of Alba, determined the Duke, he burnt 18,000 rebels to be breadcrumbed and fried, basically. Lizzie was told by Cecil, no war, and the Earl of Leicester, who was like, yes, war. Lizzie helped Holland with their Glocks and their Dosh and stuff like that. I don't know, this is so confusing about all of this, but the Netherlands were pretty, pretty important. So in 1557, the rebellion erupted in Holland. In 1579, the country was split in half, a bit like Vietnam. So North said no to they were the most rebellious. The North was like, oh, we want to rebel. And the South said, we surrender. So Lizzie funded resistance to the new Duke of Parma in 1585, which was...
Tell me...
when Mary, Queen of Scots, the year before the Babington Plot, Lizzie signed the Treaty of Nonsuch, which is such a funky word, the Treaty of Nonsuch in 1585. It protected Dutch Protestants, protected Dutch Protestants from being attacked by Catholicism. So, of course, this would have pissed Philip off like hell, because he's like, you know what, you're just adding petrol to my fire. So this isn't funny. So England and Spain were in undeclared war. In the 1570s and the 80s, Lizzie encouraged all of her priests to do their thing, basically. So war broke out in 1585 when Lizzie signed the Treaty of Nonsuch. So I guess that was a bit of a trigger. And so, Philip's plan of the Armada. Okay. We have... let's just go through the general geography of his plan. So, Philip's plan, he'll sail north to Lisbon, which is in Portugal, along the Spanish coast, destroying the English Channel. So, he would basically go, like, up and then down. He would anchor off at I think it means, like, sail north off Lisbon. Yeah, sure. Okay, he would anchor off at Calais, 17,000 soldiers from Holland, from Dunkirk, to invade England, led by Palmer, and the Armada would guard the soldiers. So 17,000 soldiers from Holland, from Dunkirk, to invade England. So I'm guessing they just sort of send the soldiers over from Holland to invade England, and they were led by Palmer, who was obviously a bad guy. Armada would guard the soldiers. So, the army would land in Margate, which was off the east coast, and do the whole invading thing. The Spanish would land and throw a bash with the English Catholics, and they all just rampage everywhere. Now, the problems that Philip faced, of course, on the 20th of April in 1587, so 2 years after war was declared, Francis Drake, attacked at Cadiz and destroying 37 ships. The number was sent to Philip as 24. So lies were already being held. The attacks delayed the plan by a year. Drake sabotaged the boats. The Spanish couldn't dock in Holland because of this whole stupid thing. And in April 1588 from Lisbon, they ran into a storm and were blown off course. So, of course, there were a lot of things that went wrong. So, in order to transport the army, they needed more ships threatened by the weather. In 1588, Palmer wanted to surrender, but Phil was determined. They had barely any soldiers. In 1588, Medina Sidonia became admiral and was absolute shite. And that was sort of at the end of it, really. But let's talk what went down. Now, I think this is right at the end. Weaknesses and failure. This is all muddled up. Okay, I'll just wipe it at the end. So, the attack at Calais. So, in the same year, in 1588, in August, they anchored off at Calais, even after all of this... all of this thing, like the weather, the boats, Francis having a bit of a go at them and stuff. So Medina Sidonia received news that Palmer wasn't showing up for another week, and Lord Howard took this opportunity. So Lord Howard, so I'm guessing who was based in South England. Lord Howard took this opportunity to send 8 unmanned ships set on fire to the Calais harbour. So this is when, you know, the whole, like, is what, you know, the Spanish Armada for, is sending flaming ships. So 8 unmanned ships set on fire to the Calais harbour. In distress, the Spanish cut anchor and sped in different directions from the Hellburners, therefore destroying Crescent Formation, which was supposed to be one of the best formations, because you can sort of attack from all angles. Anyway, Battle of the Gravelines, which was 2 days after the Hellburners were sent to Calais. The Spanish were attacked at Dunkirk, which is, I think, just a little bit east of Calais, and Battle of the Gravelines. 8 hours of fighting. The English ran out of ammo and had to retreat to the bush. Three Spanish ships were lost, but no UK ships. 1,000 Spaniards were killed, but only 50 UK kids, so that's actually not bad. So, joining with Palmer's army flopped, and the English gained lots of points. So I'm guessing Palmer's army was coming from Holland, and because they got delayed in Holland because of all of these ships, and then they got delayed because of the weather and more ships and stuff like that. So so they flopped, and Armada's threat in northern waters still posed, though, because they still had a lot of boats and stuff like this. Now, okay, so I'll just read through the book very quickly. So, the Armada sailed through the English Channel in a crescent formation, making it difficult for English to attack. The slow unmanned store ships were placed in the centre, protected by heavily armed galleons of Outer Edge and the Horns. The English fleet, led by Lord Howard Drake and Hawkins, sailed out of Plymouth. So, they actually went all the way round England, and then they faced loads and loads of terrible weather and stuff. But a crescent formation is kind of hard. And remember, the boats of the Armada were really chunky because they were obviously coming from Spain, and because this was all based around England, the England could like go back and get ammo very quickly. So the reasons for failure: Spain's weakness, lack of numbers, faulty equipment, and surprise attacks from England. English strengths: better ships, strong equipment, and they had preparation, like a lot of preparation. Now, tactics. So the advanced Spanish tactics didn't include a plan B, because obviously Philip of Spain was very stuck up and he thought his plan would work, but it didn't. And obviously the weather, which got them at Lisbon, Calais, and around the west of England, was not a good thing to happen. So the strengths of Spain: they had 30,000 well-trained soldiers. They had lots of cannons, 64 battleships, and the English soldiers were really poorly trained. English land defences were weak, and they had the best navy ever, obviously, because of what Philip had inherited. The crescent formation made it difficult. Anchoring at Calais, they only lost 2 ships, which was good. But remember, they lost all those ships at the beginning. I just need to check. In Cadiz, which I think is in Spain. But the weaknesses of Spain: they had 200 ships in the UK because they had 64 battleships. English ships were fast and light. They had 2,000 men placed around England. They had warning beacon bells. Army, Navy, led by experienced sea captains, and Spanish ships were hard to manoeuvre, of course. Right, that's all the notes I have on the Armada, but let's see if there's anything else. Battle of the Gravelines. So, the whole Hellburner thing happened at Calais. The loss of 34 ships happened at Cadiz. And the Battle of Gravelines happened at Dunkirk. That's it. And Palmer was in Holland at the time and kept on being delayed because of like all the ammo and stuff. I know I've been saying that this has been the last subject, but there's actually the Puritan threat as well. I didn't realise that. Let's move on to the next one. Okay, so the final topic, which is the Puritan threat. I did say I was going to run through some of the questions and purely for my own benefit. But we'll just run through the Puritan threat as quickly as we can. Sorry about that. Let's get right on into it. So, Puritans. It was sort of like just like the Catholics, but they were a lot more aggressive. Now, Puritans were extreme opposites of Catholics. They were simply dressed and decorated. They were they believed in a pure Puritan nation. Bit like Aryans, and they sort of rhyme a little bit. Anyway, let's jump back to John Calvin. We mentioned him earlier. He was Martin Luther's successor. So obviously Martin Luther was a Catholic. Puritans in Geneva learned and the new model of Protestantism, and they opposed bishops. Sorry, Martin Luther was Protestant. So the new model of Protestantism, which was probably like Puritanism, they opposed bishops, even though bishops were Protestant. Anyway, there's John Calvin for you. So let's jump right on to the beliefs and oppositions. So they believed as Sunday is the Lord's Day, which is fine because that's what we know anyway. The oppositions were bowing when Jesus was mentioned, which was actually part of the religious settlement, rings in marriage, celebration of saints, colourful decor, and gambling. So colourful decor was obviously Catholic. Now let's talk about the view on bishops. There was no mention in the Bible of bishops, like, whatsoever. So, bishops thought Puritans were challenging the crown, which they were, most likely. But, let's just say, that, obviously, Puritans did not like the bishops very much. The different types of Puritans. So, even though you have, like, different Christians, then you have, types of Puritans within, so it's just, like, subplots and stuff. So the moderate Protestants accepted the religious settlement, which is nice. Then you have Presbyterians, which is kind of, I think it's like a Presbyterian is like, if you pronounce it differently, it's like a life of eating fish or something, I don't know. So they wanted purity, the abolishment of bishops, and it was established in Scotland, which was really weird because Mary was around then. Then you had the separatists, who were the really extreme people and wanted to break away from the national church completely and have, like, committees and stuff. Let's talk about sex. Let's talk about the attempts of reformation, of sort of like a pure Puritan nation. So you had Walter Strickland, which is a very American name. He introduced the Book of Common Prayer and banning vestments and marriage rings. Vestments were Catholic. Parliament shut him down before he could get anything in, so that was something that sort of came and went. John Field and Thomas Wilcox. So they ensured that the bishops weren't in the Bible, so they were sort of there to prove it as well. They were critical of the prayer book, both arrested and jailed for a year. Peter Wentworth proposed a change in the government like Geneva. It failed and Hatton destroyed it. And remember, Hatton is part of the Privy Council, and he helped with the portraits. And then you had Anthony Cope, who believed in the abolishment of priests and archbishops. He argued about the freedom of speech, and he went to the Tower of London for all of this stuff. It's not actually a very chunky topic. I mean, in the book, it's only maybe I was overestimated, but I haven't got many cards on it. Anyway, so let's talk about the Puritan plots. Not as many as Catholic, but a lot nonetheless. So they had the vestments controversy in 1566, which was before all of the Catholic stuff. So the Archbishop published a book about vestments. This went against the Act of Uniformity, which was all about part of religious settlement. 37 Puritans refused to comply, and they were all dismissed. Thomas Cartwright in 1570 suggested Presbyterian system, which abolished bishops and archbishops. This meant Elizabeth lost power, so she exiled the Pope to Geneva. So Thomas Cartwright was actually the, I'm guessing, was the Pope. Not the Pope. Can't be the Pope. Maybe, I don't know. Anyway, then you had the pamphlet of John Stubbs, who was actually quite important. Basically, John Stubbs, he exposed Elizabeth as marrying a Roman Catholic, damaging her reputation, which I don't think was true. She sort of talking about marriage to him, but he heard about it. He was arrested for seditious writing, and he was imprisoned for 18 months and then had his hand cut off for obvious reasons. The Marple tracts were quite, I mean, I've only got two lines on this, but it's actually quite important. So the Marple tracts happened around the time of the Armada in 1588-89. A series of anonymous pamphlets were published called the Marplet Tracts. They were bitterly attacking the church and its bishops, with their content offended many people. While the authors were never identified, their publication lost the Puritan support and the respect. So they attacked the church, and they were very... The language was offensive and awful, and basically said, yo, we hate everything. And then everyone thought, oh, this isn't nice, we don't want to see this in our pamphlets, and then it lost a lot of popularity. So we can see that Puritans are actually very boring people in terms of rebelling. They're not very enthusiastic about sort of getting everything done and stuff like that. So how did Elizabeth deal with the Puritans? I mean, she didn't really have to do much because they were so boring. Prophesizing. So these are sort of like meetings held by Puritans. So Lizzie made Edmund Grindle ban these as they encouraged unrest and rebellion. So they were basically just like plots to overthrow. Grindle was sympathetic and refused to ban them, so she just chose the wrong person for the job because he was a coward. Lizzie confined him to his home and then fined him because he didn't do the job. John Whitgift issued 1583 prayer book, which was all about, says it here, I don't have much on here, attack on Presbyterian. When Grindle died in 1583, oh, so Grindle was basically replaced by Whitgift, who published, the Book of Prayer, which accepted bishops, the 39 Articles, and 300 to 400 ministers refused this, so it obviously wasn't very, very popular. Whitgift continued to impose strict controls over his clergy and to end all prophesizings and to suppress any other development of Presbyterian practices. So he obviously didn't like Presbyterians very much, which was fine. Right, next bit, the Separatists, which is very, very important because they're very, very aggressive people. So, they wanted to break away from the church completely. Robert Brown, with an E on the end, established a congregation in Norwich and was a leader. He was imprisoned, then went to Holland, because Holland is just, you know, the place to be at the moment. Other leaders were Henry Barrow, John Greenwood, John Penry. So they were all very basic names and probably very hard to remember, but, then, the act of seditious secretaries meant that the government could kill separatists, basically. This killed the three main leaders and the movement ended. So actually, you know, they were very boring people, like the Puritans, and good right too, because they literally had, like, they wore really boring clothes, they had really boring churches, and to be honest, I didn't know why you would want to be a Puritan. But that, if you are a Puritan, whatever, that's you, that's cool. So so this ended the seditious secretaries. And that's it. That is what all the notes I have on the Puritan threat. Of course they became a because the Catholics started stirring up, I'm guessing that the Puritans thought they had to do so too. Especially after the religious settlement, 1 year after Lizzie's crown. The Separatist movement posed the greatest threat to the settlement, as its suggestions for the church structure without controls would take away Elizabeth's power as supreme governor. It took government legislation to remove this threat. However, while Elizabeth may have crushed the radical wing, she might have destroyed the Puritan movement itself. So, I think it actually threatened Lizzie's position, and it questioned Lizzie's position rather than attack it, like these Catholics did. But that's all the notes I have on Elizabeth at the moment, so the next bit I'll just run you through all of the questions, but that is basically done. So I'm sorry if I talk too quickly, I know I do, I'm just trying to get this done before my exam tomorrow, so yeah. Right, so the questions are, there's five of them in total, and the exam guidance at the end of the book is very chunky, and I've tried to narrow it down a little bit just to make it a bit easier for the people at the back. Now, question one is only 4 marks, and it says, what can be learnt from blah, blah, blah. So what can be learnt, in the book it says, what can be learnt from sources A and B about the English attack on the Armada at Calais? So, you just create an opening sentence that says basically say, both sources provide useful because, and then you state 2 facts from source A, and then 2 facts from source B. So, you literally have to, say, this source shows that, this and this. You don't really need to include any stats, unless it's necessary. But you just have to describe the source, to be honest. So not much skill needed there. Question 2 is, to what extent does the source accurately reflect the threat of the new theatre posed to maintaining law and order during Elizabethan times? So, basically, how accurately, and this is 8 marks. So you identify key messages, you put the source into context, and you state how the source is not accurate. So you identify key points raised by the source. It can be done by underlining or highlighting. Use your knowledge of this topic area. So you literally have to say, like, the source shows how the new theatres were seen as considerable threat, blah, 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 blah. So you basically do 1 paragraph to support. And then you say, and then in the middle of, then the next paragraph would be, well, this isn't accurate because it was written by this person. And also, it's not great because of this. So you basically have to question the accuracy of the writer. And then step 3 is basically saying, going against the question. So you're saying, how does this impact upon the reliability? Make a reasoned judgment upon the accuracy. So you have to say, like, however, this is, they're writing from this standpoint and they don't understand that it might not be a threat. It might be, like, culturally, blah, blah, blah. Doesn't matter. You just have to contradict the source that you're given. Question 3. Why was this person event significant? So you place it into context. So you basically say this threat, like, or, you know, if they were saying, why was the Puritan movement seen as a significant threat to the religious settlement in 1559? You could say the threat posed by the Puritans increased, did this is what happened, blah, blah, blah. And then you have to say, you have developed and provide specific detail, including 3 issues. So, you basically have to say, while they didn't do this, they did do this, so explain what happening at the time, include specific factual detail, so 3 details. Conclude with a well-supported judgment. So this is 12 marks, so it's sort of really weird, it goes from 4 to 8 to 12, so you just say, like, however, like, the beliefs pose a significant threat, however, they weren't very rebellious, so it wasn't too bad, but, and even the most radical, the separatists, weren't even that radical. So, that's it. Question 4, which is 10 marks. Explain the connection of blah, blah, blah. So they'll give you 4 things and explain connections between 2 of the following. So it's really hard to decide what to link because you then have to talk about it. So, you start off by saying, you basically select the 2 factors and introduce them. So you have to say, during this time, this is this, and then you explain the other point, and you say, this is this. So, and then you use your knowledge and to explain and develop the connection. So there are several connections, and you have to remember to mention the 2, like, over and over again. You have to say, like, this is what happened in this time, and this is how it connects to this. So, and then you link it together, and then you whack it into some context. So, cover about 3 points, to demonstrate how 1 factor relates to the other one. So, if it's about, like, changes in farming methods and rural depopulation or rising population, or bad harvests, there's a lot you can, like, link there. But
Yeah, it is quite hard. So step four, conclude with the final sentence demonstrating, in many instances, changes to this were directly responsible for it.
So maybe something led to something else, and you could say that was the thing. Question five, the 19 marker. Ouch, not very nice. Okay, to what extent do you agree? Now, to be honest, I find question five is the most easiest, because they're quite simple. Like, all you have to say is, like, your opinion. So how far do you agree with the interpretation that of the Catholic threat to Elizabeth? So outline the summarise the interpretation and include quotes, prove the interpretation, give two examples, comment on the author and the year published, and then state a counter debate and two more examples, and then state your own opinion. So you summarise the interpretation and you have to say, so if they said, like, in reality, the danger from the Catholic threats was exaggerated. The vast majority of them were loyal to their queen and country and simply hoped for better times with Catholic Mary Stuart. Would succeed to the throne. In many instances, the constant exposure to the Protestant caused many Catholics to turn away from their faith, and only the most committed Catholics became recusants and refused to accept the religious settlement. Okay, blah, blah, blah. So, summarise interpretation. So you basically say that Catholics weren't actually that bad. So you prove interpretation. You say they were actually... Mary didn't do anything directly, not until after the religious settlement to harm to harm Elizabeth in any way, and a lot of the Privy Council and Parliament were Catholic. I think it was the House of Lords who were mainly Catholic, so a lot of rich people were Catholic, and so they didn't, and despite that, they didn't get many, like, you know, things like that. And then you could say, like, oh, but it was published in 1994, and they were writing Tudor history, like, it was published in 1994, and not the year that this was all happening, and it was and she is a specialist, and she is writing on specifically, Elizabeth I, so you could say in some ways that was accurate, and then state two counter debates, so you could just talk about the plots, and, the various things that issued there, and then just say, yo, but I believe that the Catholics were twats, and then that's it. So, I think it's actually better, to be honest. I actually prefer this one a bit more, but, they didn't write a lot here. You could say, like, plots were only supported by a small number of individuals, and blah, blah, blah. So, I know I've just made the questions seem really, really confusing, and I've actually confused myself a little bit. I would suggest going through the book, even though the book is very, very chunky, or maybe just going through it with your teacher, which might make it a little bit better. But yeah, I hope that has been okay. And that concludes my Elizabeth talk. Now, I know for some people it fluctuates, like, the courses you can take, but I'm actually doing America as well, and I might do a podcast for that, because I find these really helpful myself. If these are helpful to any of you, make sure to comment and give me a couple of listens. And thank you for those listening to my... Germany paper. It was very helpful to me, but I didn't pass very well, but that's it really. So thanks again, and I hope you find this helpful, and good luck on GCSEs. Okay, bye.